All right, guys, the great guests are coming at you fast and furious. After Peter Singer yesterday, we have today, no, not the rock star Ted Nugent, as some of you have written to me all excited that I'm speaking to a rock star. I'm even speaking to a better guest. I've got Michael Nugent, who is the chairperson of Atheist Ireland. Is that right?
That's the one, yeah. There is a Republic of Ireland, so I'll let you away with that.
And you're the co-founder of Right to Die Ireland and an author. You've written a very famous comedy musical, which we'll get into in a second, and you've got a very successful blog. How you doing, Michael? Thanks for coming on.
Grand. Looking forward to talking to you.
Oh, likewise. So let me start with a personal anecdote. So I was sitting at my local Italian cafe a few days ago, and I had gotten to know an Irish lady there. And as often happens, whenever you know that somebody comes from a particular place and there's a way for you to bond to that place, then of course you find a way to connect. So, I'm interviewing this guy from Ireland. I described who you were. She wasn't exactly sure. Then I showed her your Wikipedia page, and then she saw that you were one of the co-writers of this famous play. She said, "Oh my God, I love this play. I've seen it," and so on and so forth. So tell us first about how you got to write a play about Roy Keane, the acerbic, bellicose soccer player from Ireland.
Well, the Football Association of Ireland is kind of like a constantly exploding clown's car of an organization. And to give you an example of how they behave, in the 1980s, they once appointed a manager of the Ireland national football team by one vote, on the basis that one of the people voting thought that the other candidate was the person who had thrown a bun at him at one of the away trips. So that's the sort of level of organisation within the FAI. So in the 2002 World Cup in Saipan, they prepared for that by going to an island that didn't have a football pitch and forgetting to bring proper footballs. And it resulted in the main player on the team having a row with the manager and either getting sent home or leaving, depending on which side you were on. But it kind of became our generation's civil war, and we decided we'd write a comedy musical play about it. We called it Like Keane, and we set it as kind of like a Roman army going to war, and gave them mock Roman names, like the team coach at the time, Mick McCarthy, we called him McCarticus. Keane was still Keno. Niall Quinn, who was one of
he's a tall guy, right? The tall center
forward. He's the tall guy, yeah. We called him Quinnis, which rhymes with Guinness. Right. And Roy Keane actually came to see the play. And afterwards, he was really gracious about it. And afterwards, he was back talking to the cast. And the person who was playing Quinnis was a big Roy Keane fan in real life, and he went back to his dressing room to get his autobiography to try to get Roy Keane to sign it, and he came back out to the front, and literally, I don't mean metaphorically, he literally ran into Roy Keane, realised what he'd done, and he said, "Jesus," and Keane said, "Quinnis."
So in real life, he's not quite as steely as he was on the soccer pitch.
No, I think that's kind of an act, to be honest. Like, I don't mean an act. I think on the pitch, he's as ferocious as he seems to be. But he, you know, he's an intelligent man. He's a funny man. And I think he knew that being ferocious helped him get on.
Nice. Now, you're ready to be, before I blaspheme you regarding some of your soccer preferences, let me impress you with my soccer knowledge. I used to be a very serious competitive soccer player. And so I'm a big soccer fan. And apologies for calling it soccer. Yes, of course, it's football. But in North America,
actually, technically speaking, soccer
right.
comes the old English from association football. It's the same English kind of slang of calling rugby rugger and breakfast brecker. And the SOC in soccer is from association football.
Oh, well, there you go. So I'm about to impress you with my knowledge of Irish soccer. I hope I didn't double check, but would I be right in saying that the most stylish, non-Irish-like soccer player of all time, you ready? Liam Brady?
Liam Brady actually went to the same school as me. And he was expelled from the school. It was a Christian Brothers Catholic school. He was expelled from the school because he was picked for the St. Aidan's School Gaelic football team on the same day as he was picked for the Ireland schoolboy soccer team.
Wow.
And he was told, if you don't turn up, you needn't bother coming in again. So that's what Ireland used to be like just a few short decades ago. But yeah, Liam Brady is an absolutely classic footballer in his day.
Maybe we need
now a commentator.
Yeah, maybe we need to convince him to come out of retirement to help Arsenal from their usual implosion at this time of year, no?
Yeah, what about Leicester City, though? I mean, that's
You know what? As a romantic, I've got to support them at this point. So
yeah.
I'm all Leicester right now. Despite the fact that I would like to see Arsenal win the league, you can't not get behind them, right?
Yeah, I often think that football is worse than religion, because you can change your religion, but you can't change your football team. So now that's fine this season if you're a Leicester fan, but what have they had to put up with, you know, in the decades up to now, and now suddenly the dream is coming true for them.
You know, it's so funny you say this, and then well, I promise to those who are not interested in soccer, we'll leave the topic soon. You're talking about soccer being more than a religion. One of the times when I get most upset, and I mean, I write about a lot of very serious issues, I get pissed off when people do the Messi versus Maradona. Let me explain my position before you blaspheme. As far as I'm concerned, Maradona is to Messi what some idiot is to Charles Darwin, meaning that Messi is outlandishly superior to Maradona. Had Maradona not won the World Cup in 86, we would never have spoken about him. Had Messi won the World Cup, 2 years ago, 8 minutes away from winning it, then there would be no discussion. And so I get very, very upset just at people's thought processes when they argue that Maradona is better. So I understand what you're saying, because I actually genuinely get emotionally angry when I engage some of these folks. But
yeah, I mean, what I like about Messi is he reminds me of the 1970s footballers, that which is the era that I started following football. But, you know, when they seem to be enjoying the game, you know, there's always a smile on Messi's face, and he'll be, you know, he'll be taking shots from the edge of the box instead of just, you know, trying to do the sensible thing. And he's just a delight to watch.
And then we'll end it after this comment about soccer. And I mean, of course, we both don't know him, but in the way that he carries himself, he just seems to be a lovely human being, right? I mean, it's difficult to imagine somebody who is this great being so humble. It almost doesn't make sense that you wouldn't have a greater ego if you are that good, right?
Yeah, and there's lots of lovely videos online of, you know, kids running onto the pitch and, you know, Messi coming over to them and spending a bit of time with them, you know, when the wardens are trying to get them thrown off the pitch, and Messi's gone, no, leave him here, you know, take a photograph with him, you know, and it's really, really nice. Yeah, yeah.
And I'll say this, good luck to Leeds United. I hope they make it back to the first Premier Division soon.
Yeah, well actually, an annoying thing in terms of testing my faith or lack of faith in this year is Leeds are doing terrible, you know, for the last while. And then what they did was they brought in a Catholic priest to bless the centre circle.
There you go.
To bless the dressing room. And their fortunes have turned around since then.
So you are a believer now?
It's, well, football, as I say, football is worse than religion. I'll give myself a little out in that area.
All right, let's get down to some atheism talk. So I found a great, way to organize some of our forthcoming conversation. So you put together you wrote an article at the start of this year where here are the five challenges for atheists and secularists for 2016. So I thought maybe I would read each one, and this could serve as, you know, the basis of our conversation for the next bit. So let's start. So number one, very important one, oppose the silencing word of Islamophobia.
Yeah, I think that's just a made-up word, and it's used for political propaganda. It's used to try to silence legitimate criticism of Islam. Now, there's a big difference, I think, between Islam as an ideology, which I think is harmful, and Muslims as people, who I think are as good or bad as any other people.
Yeah.
So what the word Islamophobia does is it conflates bigotry against Muslims as people, which is a bad thing, with criticism of Islam, which is a good thing because it's important to criticize bad ideas. So I think we should stop using the word Islamophobia. We should challenge the use of the word Islamophobia. And we should recognize that if you are criticizing the harm and the human rights abuses that emanate from the ideology of Islam, which goes beyond being a religion, and in practical terms, certainly in Islamic states, is a combination of a religious and political and judicial and military ideology all rolled into one and enforced by violence. If you are challenging that and criticizing that, you're actually supporting Muslims, because most of the victims of the human rights abuses that emanate from the ideology of Islam are Muslims. Minority Muslims, women Muslims, Ahmadi Muslims, Shias if you're in a Sunni country, Sunnis if you're in a Shia country, gay Muslims. So as well as the infidels and the members of other religions, the main victims of human rights abuses by the ideology of Islam are Muslims.
You know, you're on point, and I've spoken and written about exactly this issue, and yet there is something unique about people's inability. It's as if their brains cease to function when it comes to their inability to not conflate, you know, criticism of Islam versus bigotry towards an individual or a group of people. I've got my own thoughts as to why that happens uniquely with Islam, but what are your thoughts? Why is it that otherwise reasonable and intelligent people are unable from succumbing to this trap?
Well, first of all, I think it happens mostly in Western countries. And I think part of it is that because in most Western countries, Muslims are a minority, and because in most Western countries, a lot of people will also conflate Muslims with whatever race they happen to be of, if you even accept that as a legitimate delineation within humans. But they will conflate it with race and say that you're racist if you are critical of Muslims. That would come, say, in our culture in Ireland, or more so in Britain, say, back a few decades ago, a lot of Muslims were from Pakistan, and so they would have been derogatorily called Pakis as opposed to just Muslims. And so the whole thing got conflated in that sense. So I think people probably think that they are protecting a minority from bigotry. And in many cases, they are. Like, there is bigotry against Muslims, and there are people who will conflate race and religion, who are both racists and religious bigots.
Right.
And so people think that they are protecting a minority. But in actual fact, what they are doing is they are supporting an ideology. They could still protect those people from bigotry by saying, we're opposed to religious bigotry.
Yes,
and we will protect the rights of Muslims to be treated equally before the law, to be free from discrimination, to have the same rights of freedom of conscience and religious belief as everybody else has. But then on top of that, you have at the United Nations, you have the Islamic States using the phrase Islamophobia to knowingly conflate criticism of Islam with criticism of Muslims, and to try to pretend that they are protecting Muslims, whereas in actual fact, they are the greatest human rights abusers of Muslims.
Exactly. Now, as you, of course, know, the OIC has been involved in a concerted effort for many, many years to try to pass a sort of universal dictum that makes it illegal. Now, of course, they say criticize all religions, but they couldn't give a damn about the 9,999 other religions. So in the context of, say, I know that there are blasphemy laws in Ireland, can you talk about the attempts of the OIC and contextualize it in relation to what's happening in Ireland with your blasphemy laws?
Yeah, well, we passed a new blasphemy law in 2010, which is outrageous. We're the only sort of civilized, modern, Western democratic state to pass a new blasphemy law in the 21st century. The other states have, you know, anachronistic blasphemy laws on the books from centuries ago or decades ago that they haven't got rid of yet. We passed a new one. When we passed that law, the Islamic States started to use wording from the Irish blasphemy law as what they wanted introduced internationally. As part of this whole package, as you say, that sometimes they'll call it making Islamophobia illegal, sometimes they'll call it blasphemy, sometimes they'll call it apostasy, sometimes they'll call it defamation of religion. But ultimately it's the same thing. It is about controlling criticism of Islam, because they don't mind criticism of other religions, as you say, in the states that they run. And then in some states, like when the OIC was citing Ireland's blasphemy law, they were being represented at the UN at the time by Pakistan, was their spokesnation. At the time, there's a Christian woman called Asiya Bibi who is facing execution for blasphemy in Pakistan for allegedly blaspheming against the prophet Muhammad. It was actually a row between neighbors that got translated into a blasphemy allegation. And two politicians in Pakistan who spoke out in her favor, the governor of Punjab, who was a Muslim, and the minorities minister, who was a Christian, were both murdered after they spoke out for her, one by his own bodyguard. And then when his bodyguard was taken to court for that murder, there were other lawyers throwing rose petals at his feet as he went into court. So it's an absolutely outrageous situation where you have states that are infringing on human rights to an extraordinary extent with these blasphemy / apostasy / defamation of religion laws, then trying to spread it internationally and being indirectly supported by Western states.
Well, the whole United Nations is one big farce, right? I mean, I wrote an article on my psychology blog, Psychology Today blog, at one point, where I had listed the countries of that. This was a couple of years ago. The countries that sat on the Human Rights Council of the United Nations. And I mean, it's really impossible to imagine that such a reality could exist, right? I mean, the absolute worst abusers of human rights were sitting on the Council of Human Rights. How do you explain such a disassociation from reality and what happens at the United Nations?
Well, there's two different types of things that happen at the United Nations in terms of human rights treaties. One is you have the Council, the Human Rights Council, which you've described, which is essentially a political body, and it is the states holding each other accountable, and there's so much political trade-offs and political cynicism. And as you say, Saudi Arabia, who chair not the council, but who chair a subcommittee of the council that recommends people for particular posts while they are executing people by beheading and so on. So that's one area which does need political reform and is, as you say, a bit of a shambles. Now, there is another area of the United Nations which is more productive, and that is the Human Rights Committee. Now, the difference between the Human Rights Council and the Human Rights Committee is the Council is a kind of political trade-off group. The UN Human Rights Committee is a team of independent legal experts who monitor the implementation of the human rights treaties, particularly the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Then there are other similar bodies for other treaties, the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, the Rights of the Child, Committee Against Racism, various committees like that. So I make a big distinction because we deal at United Nations level with the UN Human Rights Committees, and we find on the ground when we're talking to the committee members and at the sessions where they would be questioning Ireland on their human rights records, that they are independent experts who are genuinely, first of all, on top of what they're doing, and secondly, sincere in what they're doing. So I think you've got to split up concerns about the United Nations into the Council and the committees.
What do you think about, I mean, this idea has been floated around regarding, if you like, a new version of the United Nations where it would only be made up of true, you know, liberal, secular democracies. Do you think that such a plan could ever come to fruition, or are we stuck with the current version of the United Nations forevermore?
Well, look, it's all evolving, and I think the world is becoming more secular anyway. If you look at the, for example, the World Values Survey, which is a team of interdisciplinary social scientists who's studying human values around the world for the past few decades, what they're finding is that as people move away from survival values towards self-expression values, that moves societies away from traditional religious values and towards secular rational values, and that's triggered by things like investment in health and education and communications technology and moves towards democracy. So I think as a general trend, the world is becoming more secular.
Right.
But obviously we're nowhere near there at the moment. So at the moment, what I think we're looking at is the ideal of the United Nations that isn't there yet. But there are also, in practice, close to what you're talking about, with organizations like the European Union, NATO, the OSCE, there are, and then on the other side of the fence, the Organization of Islamic States. So there are already, you know, proto-organizations of the type that you're talking about that might evolve further and might replace the United Nations without the United Nations having to be reformed.
Yeah, got you. Final point on Islamophobia. One of the other sort of insidious elements of that word is that it pathologizes, you know, concerns of Islam, right? And it's very, very similar to what other totalitarian ideologies have done, right? I mean, in the old communist regime, I mean, if you speak out against communism, I mean, you're sent to a mental institution, right? You're sent off to the gulag because you are a loon, right? You're a loon. You need to get re-educated. We need to depathologize you. And phobia, I mean, in a strict clinical sense, I mean, deals with that. So there's this extra element, right? I mean, only a crazy, irrational person would ever feel a fear the benign nature of this great religion. So that's an additional sort of Machiavellian element to that slur, right?
Yeah, they're good at that, and it's ironically enough that the word kind of gained political currency in this part of the world in the 90s with a report by the Runnymede Trust in England, who in the report that popularized the word Islamophobia did accept that it had that problem. And indeed, that it had the other problem that we're talking about earlier on of conflating criticism of Islam with bigotry against Muslims. So I think even the people that are promoting the word recognize the problems with it, and yet, they still continue to use it.
Let's move on to number two. Promote robust civil dialogue, not internet rage. We've got a lot to talk about there, and we could link it as I think you might know where I'm going to our mutual friend PZ Myers. So tell us about that, and then we could give specific exemplars. Go ahead.
Well, look, I mean, I used to like PZ Myers years ago, and in real life, comes across as quite a nice person. He's gentle, he's reasonable when you're talking to him in person, but somehow when he gets behind the keyboard, he turns into something else. And he promotes what I have characterized in the past as an ethos of you have to be more ethical, you fuckhead. And that just doesn't work. You cannot try to promote a more ethical world, which I genuinely think that he and others on his side must have at least started out believing that this is what they were doing. But they quickly turned their advocacy into essentially an echo chamber where people who disagreed were either banned or were dogpiled by a comment policy that included PZ encouraging people to tell people to shove a rotting porcupine up their ass and to fuck themselves with a rusty chainsaw, and then ended up with PZ himself going more and more and more into the internet equivalent of a shock jock on radio, and just turning everything up to 11 immediately. So when he was criticizing Richard Dawkins, he couldn't just say, "I think you're mistaken about this." He would say that Richard Dawkins, seems to have, developed a some sort of lack of empathy with sexually abused children.
I know.
And then would leave comments on his blog saying things like, Richard Dawkins, if he isn't actually a paedophile, he's very close to wearing the uniform of one. Richard Dawkins and his rape apologists can go fuck a socket. So he would leave those type of comments on his blog, and yet when people would defend Richard Dawkins against these type of things, he would say, "We don't need any more of your hero worship around here. Fuck off." So, I mean, that kind of behavior, and what's kind of strange about it is because it happened relatively gradually. I think a lot of us became immune to how outrageous it was, and we were kind of reasoning with it and with him as if this was normal behavior. But what I find is now, if I'm talking in retrospect, now that it's all behind us and he's lost the influence that he used to have, and I'm, say, telling people who aren't involved in the atheist community about it, they're absolutely stunned. They're saying, "What? What is this?" And then I tell them that this guy is a university professor, and they go, "What?" So it's I think what we've got to do is we've got to recognize that you can and should robustly criticize bad ideas and hold people accountable for bad behavior without just descending into that level of abuse and without normalizing that level of abuse.
Well, I'll tell you how he got on my radar. I had no idea who this guy was until So let me backtrack a bit. I think in 2010, there's a evolutionary psychologist who's a professor at London School of Economics, Satoshi Kanazawa, who was a very, very... Are you familiar with this case? Do you know where I'm going with this?
No.
Okay. So let me give you a bit of the background. He was a very, very popular blogger at Psychology Today. He was a bit bombastic in his style, always pushing the envelope. And at one point, he had written an article where he was describing someone else's research that had come to the conclusion that, on average, people find black women as, you know, less attractive than other women. I don't remember the exact details. And, you know, the way he had phrased the, you know, his title and so on, you know, I would have gone with a slightly, you know, tamer style. Of course, there was a huge backlash against him. He should be feathered. He should be tarred. He should be killed. He should lose his tenure. And Myers took this article that's coming from an evolutionary psychologist, and basically had written something on his blog to the effect of, this is what evolutionary psychology is. It's a bunch of, you know, rabid racists, right? Well, that type of stereotypical, I mean, that kind of blanket thinking is precisely how racism forms, right? You catch an accountant who cheated on his taxes and he happens to be Jewish. There you go. Jews are a bunch of cheats, right? Now, if you did that, if you succumbed to that cognitive bias, then we would call you a racist or an anti-Semitic person. But P.Z. Myers could then tar the whole field of evolutionary psychology made up of very, very serious scientists. And as you may or may not know, that's the area that I work in. I apply evolutionary psychology in the behavioral sciences and in consumer behavior in particular. I thought it was breathtaking that a university professor, as you said, who is a evolutionary biologist or developmental biologist, you know, who otherwise is fully appreciative of how you apply evolutionary theory to study all sorts of phenomena when it comes to animals, was completely against the idea that these exact same principles might be applied to the study of the human mind. And I thought that was so grotesque, not only in how idiotic his position was, but in the style with which he presented it. And so that's how I originally became acquainted with him. And then since then, of course, I've followed a few of the other, you know, battles. I mean, why do you think that is? I mean, is it that he doesn't have enough self-insight? And we're using P.Z. Myers, but of course, this phenomenon applies to dialogue on the internet in general. What is it that makes people... I mean, it's not like he can hide behind anonymity, right? Because oftentimes you say, oh, people behave poorly on the internet because they're anonymous. Well, he's not anonymous. So what is it that makes him be such a bad guy in his online persona? And yet, as you said, when you meet him, it doesn't seem to jive with that persona. What's going on?
I think it could be...
There's a cat behind you.
Sorry?
There's a cat behind you.
Oh, good. It could be only one of five.
Which
one
is it?
Oh, yeah. Hey, you boo. Yeah. It's... I think it probably comes down to surrounding yourself just with people that you agree with and banning people that you disagree with. And then once you reach that stage, everything you say, you know, you're just going to get support for. And then the othering of those that disagree and painting them as subhuman effectively, right, is a good way to not have to think about what they're saying. And then I think it probably just becomes... almost habit, you know, and we become, and I'm sure he does as well, becomes desensitized to how outrageous it is, and so I mean, for example, we talk about hate speech as in the abstract, and if people say things that are hateful, we say that's hate speech. But PC actually literally says that he hates people. He names people that he says he hates and despises and holds in contempt, and they're often, you know, quite moderate people like Karen Armstrong, you know, and so I think you can start by being very critical of people that perhaps deserve a lot of criticism, and then just keep going down the line until you're applying the same outrageous standards to just normal individuals.
Well, so to sort of build on your echo chamber argument, you know, if you ask professors, how well do you think you did this year in terms of your teaching effectiveness, then of course a lot of the professors are going to say, oh, I think I did fantastically well. And then when they received their teaching evaluations, they're surprised that it wasn't quite as well as what they thought. And the reason for that is that there's a bias in terms of the feedback that they've received, right? The students who thought that the professor was great are likely to have gone to him or her and say, hey, I really enjoyed your class. I thought it was great. The students who thought that he was a horrible professor probably didn't go to his office hours to say, you know, you really sucked this semester. And therefore, you develop a wrong frequency distribution of the good and the bad. And so I think what's happening in the case of this gentleman, as you said, I mean, if he's got a phenomenally popular site, right, where, you know, thousands of people are supporting his every move, I think this is exactly why he succumbs to this behavior. So I think you're exactly right. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, the site isn't as popular as it used to be, but okay. Certainly at its peak, that, you know, that was certainly the case. But as you say, it's partly the depersonalizing impact of just being on the internet, and why I think that even though he isn't anonymous, he's a different person when he's online,
right,
than he is in real life. If you're sitting down and having a chat with him, he is one of the nicest people to talk to.
Wow.
But then, as I say, when he gets behind the keyboard, he just turns into something else.
So what is the, so removing it from this particular gentleman, so what are some recommendations you could give in terms of how people should not succumb to that second point? Is it always never personalize things, always just attack the content of people's ideas, never turn it personal, I guess, right?
Yeah, or recognize that you are actually dealing with real people who have the same emotions as you have, who in most cases genuinely believe what it is they're saying in the same way as you do. And if you're angry about something, I mean, there's a place for anger. There's a lot of things that make me angry about the world. But use that anger to motivate you to try to address the problems rather than to attack the people. We have a saying in Atheist Ireland, which is, you have rights, your beliefs do not. And we use that to try to convey that we should respect people and respect people's rights to believe whatever it is they believe, but we still don't have to respect the content of their beliefs, and we can challenge the content of their beliefs as robustly as is appropriate, while recognizing that they are basically most of the time good people.
Makes perfect sense. Let's move on to the next one. Normalize the use of the word atheism. What do you mean by that?
Well, this kind of comes back, I suppose, in our context of Ireland, when Atheist Ireland started, the word atheism wasn't even used in public discourse a lot. If it was, it was used as an insult. You'd have reference in Parliament maybe to, historically to, you know, the godless communists and things like that. And then more recently, it would be used as you know, some sort of catch-all for strange outsiders. But so we wanted to normalise the use of the word atheism. And atheism. We want people to recognize it's not really a weird concept. It's broadly speaking just recognizing nature and reality as it is, without having to add in supernatural explanations for things that are happening. And so we specifically target that. We felt that a lot of people say, particularly if you're involved in political lobbying, which Atheist Ireland would be involved in, well, maybe you shouldn't call yourself atheists, because there's bias and prejudice against atheists. People won't take you seriously. People will be concerned about what you're saying. Maybe call yourself a humanist, call yourself non-religious, call yourself a free thinker or whatever. But we took the attitude that if you keep running away from the word, you just reinforce that prejudice. And the only way to chip away at the prejudice is for people to be seen to be doing natural, good things while self-identifying as atheists. And we have found now that since like last year in the Irish Parliament, the words atheist and atheism were used last year alone 15 times as often as, or sorry, were used as often as in the 15 years cumulatively before Atheist Ireland was founded 8 years ago. And increasingly, the words are now being used in a descriptive sense rather than in a pejorative sense. Increasingly, they're being used when parliamentarians are, you know, quoting from or asking questions about briefing documents that Atheist Ireland would have provided when relevant bills are coming up. And now it is, for example, when we're interviewed on the radio or television in Ireland or in newspapers, they don't have to precede the discussion with, let's explain what atheism is, and let's explain, you know, what Atheist Ireland is. So it's, I know it's baby steps in terms of just being part of the discourse, but it's the first step that's necessary in order to start to be able to promote atheism and reason.
Very nice. Next, well, of course, that's a grand one, but promote fundamental human rights. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, that comes back to what I was saying about the United Nations Human Rights Committees as opposed to the councils. And what Atheist Ireland has decided to do is to focus most of our political advocacy on the foundation of internationally agreed human rights. And by that we mean very fundamental rights, things like freedom of religion, conscience and belief, freedom from discrimination, equality before the law, the rights of the child, the right to private and family life. These are very fundamental basic rights that from a governmental perspective, you know, don't involve arguments about financial resources. You know, they don't have to be gradually implemented. They don't have to be balanced against the rights of others. These are very fundamental rights that we base all of our activities on. And the advantage of that is twofold. One is that obviously, you know, we should be doing it anyway. And the second is it's harder for people to argue against us if we are basing our political campaigns on human rights standards, because we're not saying, you know, okay, this is, there are areas where there's legitimate disagreement. What's best for society? Should we do this? Should we do that? But we're going below that, and we're saying this is the foundation upon which those type of discussions should be built, is recognizing that everybody should be treated equally, and on that basis, we also campaign for the rights of minority faith members in Ireland, and indeed for Catholics who don't believe all of the theology of the Catholic Church. So we find, for example, the Evangelical Alliance of Ireland support our campaign for secular schools, because they too are discriminated because they can't get access to schools that are consistent with their conscience as evangelical Protestants. We find that whereas the Islamic organizations are looking for Muslim schools, some of the Muslim parents are looking for secular schools, right, for the same reason, that you'll only get at most a small number of Muslim schools, and Muslims throughout the rest of the country aren't going to have access to them. So we feel that this is, it's just a significantly both right and advantageous foundation to try and build our campaigning on.
Now, I mean, that objective is much easier to implement in the context and the landscape of Ireland than it would be globally. So, for example, if you think about the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights, right, which is based on Sharia, well, then, you know, many of the things that you and I would take as a non-starter sort of bedrock fundamental human rights are perfectly antithetical and inconsistent with the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights. And so you can't just appeal to those folks and say, hey, gee, you know, accept our definition of human rights. Yes, clear thinking people it should be obvious that what we're saying is a given, but how do you break through the impenetrable wall of ideologies that are, as I said, perfectly antithetical to those rights?
Well, the Cairo Declaration, as you say, it's kind of like the discussion we were having earlier about Islamophobia. The Cairo Declaration isn't actually a declaration on human rights. It's an attempt to promote Sharia under the guise of something that has the words human rights attached to it. But the most significant parts of that declaration are the parts that say that that everything in it has to be interpreted according to Sharia. So that's actually, it's the Cairo Declaration on Sharia. It's not the Cairo Declaration on human rights. So ultimately, yes, you're right, first of all, in your first point. What we're talking about is in terms of the human rights things, is advantageous in terms of Western secular liberal democracies. You know, that's where it's useful to focus on that on those issues. In Islamic states, and I don't mean just Islamic state as the you know, the current entity, but in states that are governed by Sharia, You know, it is a much more difficult problem. But if you look at the world that we live in today, compared to the world when we were kids, you know, we've seen the fall of the Berlin Wall. We've seen the end of apartheid in South Africa. We've seen the collapse of the Soviet Union. We've seen, I mean, not quite as dramatic because Ireland was never as bad as those places, but we've seen Ireland become the first country in the world to legalize gay marriage by popular vote as opposed to by courts or by parliaments. So we're living in a world where even in the most oppressive, seemingly unchangeable regimes, that change can happen. And indeed has happened in the you know, Middle East and North Africa and the places that are most influenced by Islam. Hasn't happened necessarily to the better, but is still in a volatile state where things, political changes that would have seemed unthinkable a short time ago are always possible. Now, nobody knows what's going to trigger those changes. And I'm not saying that atheist advocacy is going to trigger those changes, or that anything specifically will. But something will happen.
Right.
You know, something will trigger, just something, maybe something accidental, or something just in society. Something will happen that will trigger those changes. And when that does happen, then all of this work will retrospectively have become useful. So I think what we've got to do at the moment is try to bring about or protect changes in the Western world and try to stand in solidarity with those people in Islamic states and indeed in other non-Islamic repressive regimes who are trying to bring their societies forward in terms of just basic values.
And so related to this point is the idea of when you have immigrants that come from some of these cultural and religious backgrounds coming to the West, then of course there is a clash. Some people like to argue that there isn't a clash, but there is a fundamental clash of values. Now, of course, if you subscribe to the political philosophy of multiculturalism, where we should not criticize others because who are we to judge others? It's cultural relativism, moral relativism. Then even criticizing something as grotesque as child brides or honor killings or female genital mutilation becomes something that you're reticent to do, lest you might offend the sensibilities of the other. So I'm assuming that your position is that, hey, people are welcome to join us in our secular liberal democracies as long as they leave those values that are antithetical to those, to our values, at the door, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Look, in the Western world, we have broadly advanced beyond the stage that people are relying on religious diktats for their morality. We broadly recognize that morality is based on human attributes like compassion and empathy and reciprocity and cooperation and fairness and justice. And we've broadly built societies that are based on recognizing human rights and increasingly recognizing it with more nuance and increasingly recognizing the rights of non-human animals. So we're moving towards a society that isn't based on religious diktats written thousands or hundreds of years ago that say that even if this is the most compassionate thing to do, you still shouldn't do it because somebody wrote it in a book. If you look at Islam, one of the most significant passages in the Quran is where it says that you should flog adulterers a certain number of times and don't let your compassion stop you while you're doing it. Now, clearly that second bit had to be added in because there were Muslims who were going, look, this is disproportionate, this is unethical, we shouldn't be doing this. And so what any theocratic, and indeed you could extend this to secular ideologies like communism and fascism and so on, any ideology that is based on faith and dogma is going to be worse for people than ideologies that are based on compassion and empathy and human rights as we understand them in the West. So I'm quite happy to say that I believe that Western liberal democratic values are objectively better for society and for people than are the values that are espoused by Islamic states. And if people want to be part of our society from wherever they come, I don't mind what they believe, but they should be held accountable in their behavior to the laws of the land in the same way as everybody else is.
I mean, it seems so extraordinarily simple to understand this. and yet people are infected, I mean, literally with a virus of the human mind that does not allow them to process this breathtakingly obvious statement that you just said. So yeah. Hopefully your work...
What I think it comes down to is some people genuinely but mistakenly believe that what they're doing is protecting vulnerable minorities.
Right.
And that's a, you know, a valuable goal to have, but that's not what they're doing in this case. Because even if you take Islamic communities within the West, there's repression going on within those communities in terms of the Sharia courts and in terms of the pressure that is put on women and certainly if you're a gay Muslim, even if you're in the West, you're in a slightly better position than being in an Islamic state. You are still in danger of not having the same protection of the law of the land as everybody else has. And there should be one law for everybody based on democratically accountable and equally enforced police services that treat everybody equally regardless of their beliefs.
Right. Fifth one, of course, another sort of obvious one, grand one, promote ethical secular democracy. Why do you need to put ethical? Is it because some secular states would have been sort of communism? That would not be an ethical? Okay.
Yeah, I think all three words there are important.
Okay.
I think you need an ethical state, you need a secular state, and you need a democratic state. Because particularly, if you look back at things like the World Values Survey, or if you look generally at the complaints that people have about, you know, North Korea and communism and Russia and so on and so forth, and China and places like that, there are two things that are important. And if you look at societal outcomes in countries that have ethical secular democracies, you'll find that in countries like Scandinavian, Northern European countries, places like that, that they have, and in America, the more liberal secular states have better outcomes than the Bible Belt states. You will find that there are less murders, there are less teenage pregnancies, there are less abortions, there are less of all of the things that religion is supposed to protect us against, and that secular and atheist people are found in surveys to be less nationalistic, less ethnocentric, less racist, less prejudiced, and more politically tolerant. So I think all three of those aspects, ethical secular democracies, are what are needed to bring about both human rights and the best societal outcomes. Now, in terms of Ireland, we have specific issues that we need to do here. They involve things like removing our blasphemy law, bringing about a secular education system. Currently, the Catholic Church runs 90% of Irish primary schools and runs them with a Catholic ethos running through the entire curriculum and with exemptions from our equality laws that allow them to discriminate against, but not only families, but also against teachers. We have religious oaths for president and judges and members of the Council of State, who includes the Prime Minister and so on. So, which means, ironically, that if you were charged with blasphemy in Ireland, you could only be tried before a judge who has sworn to ask God to direct and sustain them in their work. Right. So there are those specifics that will be different to each country in terms of how you build an ethical secular democracy. We also work alongside other groups, other advocacy groups, that are discriminated against in other areas. Some, there's an overlap in terms of women's rights and in terms of gay rights, where religious bigotry built into our constitution has, you know, led to a range of discriminations against different groups, and others where the discrimination, for example, the travelling community in Ireland is very much discriminated against, and other groups that we will try to work alongside to get human rights for everybody.
Nice. Now let me give you an optimistic good news and a pessimistic one. I think it is completely conceivable that if we had a crystal ball and we could look 100 years from now, that secularism will have spread more than it has today. Now, here's the bad news from the perspective of two non-believers. I don't think necessarily that atheism will increase or that religiosity will decrease. Now, I say this So I've written as an evolutionary scientist. Of course, one of the things that I'm interested in is the evolutionary roots of religion, right? I mean, to actually study what are some evolutionary reasons that make us so that make religion so compelling to us. And so in one of my books, in The Consuming Instinct, I have a chapter which I titled "Marketing Hope by Selling Lies," where I give different manifestations of highly successful peddlers of hope, medical quacks, self-help gurus. Well, no peddler of hope is greater than religion, because it ultimately, quote, solves for me the greatest, most fundamental problem, and that is my existential angst, right? I really don't like the idea that you and I will not be sitting here in 100 years having another great conversation. And if I've got Lipitor, if I've got a cholesterol problem, I go see my physician, he gives me the Lipitor pill, and everything is good. But I've got to solve that existential problem, and I need a pill. And that pill comes very nicely packaged in the form of religion. And so to the extent that we've got a prefrontal cortex that is aware of our looming mortality, I think it's going to be very difficult to remove religiosity as almost the default position of people. So you and I think, will always be in the minority in our non-belief, because it's certainly a lot more comforting to belief. What do you think?
Well, okay, I think that what's happening is that, first of all, I think science is gradually replacing the religious worldview of reality, and that's becoming harder and harder to sustain. I think that ethical secular democracy will over time replace the religious views of morality as being based on, you know, some supernaturally revealed instructions that you have to do. So I think that as that is happening, and that seems to tie in with the World Values Survey results, you know, that the world is becoming more secular as people are moving away from survival values and towards self-expression values at different speeds in different countries. I think that seems to be happening. Now, what then I think is likely to happen and is happening is that you get two responses from people. One is either they will accept this new reality and will become more, if not necessarily, atheist. And the other is you will get people who will resist the new reality and will become more fundamentalist. So I think you'll get simultaneously a rise in secularism and a rise in religious fundamentalism, and that the kind of moderate religious middle will be squeezed at both ends. Now, the other thing that I think is pretty significant at the moment in terms of Catholicism is that Catholicism is now becoming, by that I mean Roman Catholicism, is becoming increasingly a religion of the developing world. There's 2/3 of Roman Catholics are now in Southeast Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, Central and South America, whereas 100 years ago, the vast majority of Roman Catholics were in Western Europe and North America. So the Catholic Church, which is the biggest single Christian institution, is increasingly, and under the current Pope, who for example recently endorsed an organization of exorcists and who talks about the devil as a person more frequently than previous popes does, who is essentially a pope of the global south, with good PR in the global north, but is essentially a pope of the global south. We're going to see that, plus Islam resisting the advances of secular democracy. Who knows how it's going to work out? I tend to be optimistic. I do think that in the overall sweep of history, that the world is becoming more secular. But I take your point that it's not going to be an easy route, and a lot of people probably won't take the extra step of self-identifying as atheists,
right,
and will just go along with just going for a more tolerant society where they will say, yeah, we respect other people's beliefs, which, ideally they shouldn't respect the content of other people's,
right,
beliefs. But if people start behaving respectfully to each other, that might be as much as we can hope for in pragmatic terms.
Well, I think one of the difficulties of fighting against religiosity, and I use here a analogy to consumer behavior. So if a firm is trying to target children to sell them chewing gum and cereals, well, there are ethical, moral, if not legal rules that say you're not allowed to target this child if he or she is below a certain age, because they don't have yet the cognitive apparatus to counter your persuasive intent. Of course, on the other hand, when it comes to one particular product called religion, the baby comes out of the womb and have at him, right? So it, you know, on the one hand, I'm unable to target a child to sell them chewing gum if they're under 8 years old or whatever the number is, but I could give them my preferred religious narrative from the age of zero. Well, how could the child ever hope to stand a chance against that dogma? So in other words, what I'm saying is it's almost the default value for people to grow up being religious. You and I will always be in the minority if the landscape remains the way that it is now. And so it's in that sense that I'm pessimistic. I'm not at all pessimistic about the spread of secularism, but it's just so difficult. It's a lot easier to spread secularism than to eradicate religiosity.
Yeah, I think what you've got to do is move below religiosity and challenge the concepts of faith and dogma themselves. And as I say, whether they're applied to religious or to secular projects. Now, the difference between them being applied to secular projects, like I was at that movie the other day, the Big Short, mm-hmm. about some of the guys who figured out before the housing bubble burst in America, right. figured out that, you know, they followed the evidence and they went, okay, this is going to happen. They were effectively betting against the housing market. The banks were taking their money happily because they thought that they were idiots. And but they turned out to be right because they were following the evidence, and the banks were effectively the equivalent of religions. You know, they, right. they were just there going, they had faith in the system that was there, and they had faith that people would always pay their mortgages, and they had faith that the market, housing market, would never collapse. But the difference between that type of faith and religious faith is that type of faith, as was shown in that, eventually bumps into reality,
right.
and eventually the market does collapse. And so people go, oh, right, well, we've got to change our views. Whereas religious faith hides its testability
right.
in this imaginary afterlife. And so it manages to survive for longer than it should. So I think if we are prepared to equate secular faiths with religious faiths and secular dogmas with religious dogmas, and then collectively challenge the concepts of faith and dogma themselves, rather than just attacking religion, I think that might be a way to enable some people to come around to it in a way that they mightn't if you just seem to be attacking only religion.
Very nicely put. I'd like to, as I always tell my guests, and I'm being truthful, I could keep you here for another 5 hours chatting, but we need to end it soon. I'd like to end with a great quote, and you tell me who wrote this quote, because I think it's fantastic. So here we go. You ready?
Okay, go ahead.
All right, here we go. So bear with me. So this is to the point that atheists are arrogant because they don't believe that the most... Now the quote begins here. That the most powerful being ever created a universe of over 100 billion galaxies, each with over 100 billion stars like our sun, which existed for 14 billion years and then picked one of the 100 billion galaxies and picked one of the 100 billion stars in that galaxy and picked one planet revolving around that star, and of the million species on that planet, he picked one animal member of all those species and said, I love this conclusion. I've really got to tell that guy to stop gathering sticks on the Sabbath.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary set of priorities for somebody should be so busy.
For those of you who haven't figured it out, that's a quote from Michael. As I was going through your website, looking at some of your articles, I read that and I said, oh, that's fantastic. I have to mention it tomorrow. So folks, go check out Michael's blog. Is there anything else that you'd like to promote? I will put in the descriptor below the clip whatever you'd like me to, but if you'd like to say something right now to promote a project that you're working on or anything else that we haven't touched upon, please do so now.
The one thing that we haven't touched on, which is I'm also involved in a group called Rights to Die Ireland,
oh, yes.
which campaigns for assisted dying. My late wife died of cancer a few years ago, and when she was dying, she had made preparations to be able to take her own life if she needed to. Now, she wasn't afraid of dying, but she didn't want to undergo any unnecessary suffering at the end. And so it's a campaign that's very dear to my heart for that reason. And I think what I would like to convey to people who are dubious about it or who have concerns about it is that the right to assisted dying is not merely about the act of dying. It's about the increased quality of life that you have while you're still alive by knowing that you have the peace of mind of not being forced to undergo unnecessary suffering before you do die. So that's it's a really, really important thing to me personally and to a lot of people. And it's an area where, kind of like abortion, where ultimately the law is going to have to catch up with reality, because people in that position are going to act in accordance with their own conscience anyway, and not in accordance with you know uncompassionate and unempathetic laws. So that'll be the one thing, as well as atheism and secularism. The right to assisted dying is a campaign that I'd like to see more people getting involved in.
Well, thank you for mentioning this, and my belated condolences. I hate to end it on such a negative note, but
no, it's a positive note. It's right. A positive note, really. It is, because, as I say, it is about quality of life and not merely about dying. And ultimately, you know, whatever amount of time that we do have here, it's going to end for all of us at some stage. So it's important that we try to enable people to face the end in as positive a frame of mind as possible.
Wonderful way to end. I'm about to stop it, but stay on the line. Thank you so much, Michael, for taking the time to chat with me today.
Thank you for inviting me.